Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, we're going to talk about what everyone is talking about, and that is the tragedy of Hurricane Sandy. First of all, my heart goes out to those people who suffered so much from that monster hurricane which ravaged the Northeast. It's tragic that so many lives were lost. It's also tragic that so many homes were destroyed in the wake of this gigantic hurricane. In fact, some estimates put it at about $50 billion in property damage, not to mention ruined lives. And the question that we're going to ask today is, why? Why did we have Hurricane Sandy? And are there more hurricanes waiting to happen? And what about global warming? First of all, this was, of course, the hurricane from hell. And what made it so distinctive is because it was the byproduct of the collision of three large air masses, creating an animal that we've never really seen before. First of all, three large air masses collided off the coast of Florida. First of all, we had an ordinary hurricane. A garden variety hurricane wouldn't amount to much at all. However, it collided with the jet stream. Now, the jet stream takes cold Arctic air, and it goes down through Canada, perhaps swings through the Dakotas, and goes back into Canada again. However, this time the jet stream went all the way down to Florida. Very unusual that we had this ice-cold weather coming from Canada and Alaska, going all the way down to Florida, colliding with the hurricane that was already there. And then third, we also had a storm, a low-pressure area coming in from the west. So we had a storm from the west. We had the jet stream carrying cold air from the north. And then from the east, we had an ordinary hurricane. And the collision of these three large air masses created a witch's brew that scientists had a hard time modeling with their computers. In fact, it created this hybrid monster, a hybrid of a hurricane and a nor'easter, very rare atmospheric collision. And it created an air mass that was huge, about 800 miles across. Now, normally, hurricanes are not that big, and they circulate very quickly. However, this time, the air mass was extremely large and circulated very slowly. And that's what made it so different from all the other hurricanes that we've experienced in the past. And then the next question is, why? Why did we have this gigantic hybrid monster being created off the coast of Florida? Well, first of all, let me say flatly that there's no smoking gun. You cannot point to one factor and say, aha, that's the reason why we had Hurricane Sandy. However, if you take a look at the average effects, you see rather disturbing trends. First of all, where does the energy of a hurricane come from? The energy of a hurricane comes from warm water, specifically the warm water of the Gulf and the Caribbean. Well, it turns out that parts of this body of water are about 5 degrees above normal, up to 5 degrees above normal. And that creates more energy to drive the hurricane. Also, the ferocity of a hurricane is related to the difference in temperature between the outside and the inside. The greater the difference in temperature, the faster the winds move and the more energy you have. Well, on the outside, we had the jet stream. The outside carried cold air from the Arctic. So it was the collision of the cold air from the Arctic with unusually warm water off the Caribbean, which gave the energy for Hurricane Sandy. And then the question is, well, what does that imply for global warming? Well, global warming isn't really a misnomer. It should be called global swings, or in other words, the weather on steroids. Global warming, we have this image of the Earth uniformly rising in temperature. That's not the correct image. The correct image is energy, extra energy sloshing around the planet Earth, excess energy that has to go someplace. That means in one part of the Earth, we could have forest fires. Another part of the Earth, we could have droughts. Another part of the Earth, we can have massive flooding. Another part of the Earth, we could have hurricanes. In other words, what global warming really does is, on average, accentuate trends that already exist on the planet Earth. And that's why it's so disturbing. Also, realize that global warming causes sea levels to rise. In fact, sea levels in the last 100 years have risen about a foot. Now, for every vertical foot of rise, you lose about 50 to 100 horizontal feet of shoreline. This means that our shores are, in fact, contracting. And this bodes ill for the amusement industry and the vacation industry and the economy, which depends upon visitors coming to the shore. As sea levels rise, it means that storm surges become much more ferocious. It means that it's much more difficult to contain storm surges because of the rise in sea level. Also, the jet stream has been irregular. And some people believe that perhaps it's due to the fact that, because of global warming again, the polar ice caps are receding. In fact, every major glacier on the planet Earth is receding at the present time. Photographs taken 50, 100 years ago show a completely different arrangement of the glaciers on the planet Earth. Not to mention the fact that the North Polar region is thinning by 50% over the last 50 years. Submarines that have visited the North Pole have shown that the thickness of the polar ice caps has decreased by 50% over the last 50 years. So it's estimated that perhaps by mid-century or late in this century, all the polar ice will be gone. And our grandkids will know that we're lying when we talk about Santa Claus, because even our grandkids will know there is no North Polar region. So then the next question is, well, what do we do about it? Well, there's short-term and long-term implications. In the short term, some people are saying, let's build a seawall. Let's replenish the sand of our beaches, and let's rebuild the homes. Well, there's some debate about all these questions. First of all, a seawall is possible, but a sea gate may actually be better than a seawall. You see, if you have a seawall, the wave comes in and bounces off with tremendous amounts of energy. You see, when a wave comes into a normal beach, it gently dissipates. So the energy of the wave dissipates as it heads toward the seashore. And that minimizes beach erosion. However, if you put a seawall, then the wave bounces back with the same velocity that it came in, and it takes away sand as a consequence. So ironically enough, areas which put up a seawall 10 years later have shown significant erosion more than areas did not put in a seawall. So in other words, just building a seawall may not be the best possibility because of the fact that the reflected wave carries a lot of kinetic energy, which takes away the sand. Well, you see, a beach in some sense is like a living thing. Sand comes in, sand comes out. Sand naturally washes out due to the waves. But where does sand come from? Sand mainly comes from sandy sediment from rivers. But America, of course, is famous for damming every single river in sight. And the reduced flow of dammed water has also decreased the replenishment of sand on our beaches. So unfortunately, the beaches, which serve as a tourist attraction, generates money for the economy and jobs for the economy. We're just going to have to get used to the fact that the oceans are gradually going to reclaim the beaches. And that means that all the beaches will eventually wash into the Atlantic. That doesn't mean that you can't replenish it with new sand. That's what Miami Beach did. In fact, that's partly the reason why South Beach, Florida has been reinvigorated, because of the fact that they spent about $50 million bringing in sand from the outside. And that's a temporary fix. It means that every decade or so, you're going to have to put more sand on the beach because sand will wash into the oceans. And so then now let's take a look at the long-term implications. The long-term implications are not very good. Because have you noticed that we've been having wacky weather recently? 100-year forest fires, 100-year droughts, 100-year floods, 100-year hurricanes. I mean, it's getting monotonous. Everything is 100-year this, 100-year that. And the question is, well, if you complete the dots, maybe the reason why we're having 100-year this and 100-year that is because of global warming. Now, as I said before, there's no smoking gun. Global warming is an average effect. You have to average the weather over many years. However, all the signs are consistent. All the indicators show that the Earth is warming and it's causing havoc. Every indicator points up. We see the recession of the glaciers. We see the thinning of the polar ice caps. We see the fact that 2010 tied with 2005 as the hottest years ever recorded in the history of science. Also, the decade of 2000s went down as the hottest decade ever recorded in the history of science. We also see monster irregularities with droughts and flooding existing simultaneously. We also see tropical diseases going northward because tropical diseases can flourish when the temperature starts to rise. We also see that the summers are longer than normal. The seasons themselves are being thrown off kilter. And so all the indicators point up. The fact that the Earth is warming, and with 90% confidence, many scientists believe that this is due to human activity. Now, to be fair, there are some people who say, bah, humbug. They're getting smaller and smaller and smaller, but there are such people. And they claim that the Earth is actually warming because of natural cycles. Now, of course, natural cycles can always exist. However, you have to take a look at the longer-term trend to see the big picture. Now, it turns out that the Earth has been warming for the past 10,000 years. 10,000 years ago, where I'm standing right now in Manhattan, was under about half a mile of ice. And so it is true that for the past 10,000 years, the Earth has been naturally heating up as part of a long-term cycle. However, that said, you have to realize that in the last few decades, we've seen an acceleration of all these effects. So this is new. This is not a byproduct of the melting of the glaciers stemming from the ending of the last ice age. We're talking about the fact that the temperature of the Earth is accelerating now because of human activity. In fact, you can even actually measure this numerically. It's not that difficult to calculate the total amount of sunlight that the Earth receives from the sun. With our satellites, it's not that hard to calculate the total amount of energy being lost into outer space. Two very simple numbers that you can calculate. And when you compare these two, they should be the same, but they're not. Bingo. There is a deficit. And where does this extra energy come from? You put in human activity, and it fits perfectly well. So in other words, the amount coming in and the amount leaving the Earth is different because of human activity. Also, in the last few minutes of exploration, I'd like to say a few things about the doomsayers who say that this hurricane is actually part a prelude to December 21st, 2010, when we have Armageddon itself. Well, in future programs of exploration, I'll get more into it. However, let me say right now that come next month, come December, don't sell the store. Don't quit your day job, because you may very well live to see Christmas 2012. And my own personal point of view is the Mayan calendar actually does say that one cycle ends, but another cycle begins on December 21st, 2012. In other words, it's New Year's. We should be celebrating rather than talking about doomsday and Armageddon. The planets are not aligning, so we're not going to have a Jupiter effect that rips the Earth apart. There is no planet X. There is no 10th planet barreling through the heavens on a dead-end course with the planet Earth. The black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy is quite stable, and it is 30,000 light years away, a very comfortable distance to be from a black hole. And so, for all these reasons, I believe that we're simply not going to have a catastrophe on December 21st, 2012. However, there is one thing to look out for. It's not going to end the Earth. It's not cataclysmic by any means. However, every 11 years, the sun throws a temper tantrum, and once every few hundred years, the sun goes out of control and emits a burst of energy, the likes of which we've never seen before. Now, realize that the electric age and the space age are quite young, We're not used to feeling the effects of a gigantic monster solar storm, not hurricane, but a solar hurricane. We're not used to feeling the effects of it. But now we are in the electric age. We are in the space age. We are highly dependent upon satellites. And you can tell from the last hurricane that if you lose your power, you're literally thrown back about 100 years into the past before the coming of electricity. That could happen again. No one knows when. No one has a crystal ball. But sometime in the future, it's inevitable that the sun will erupt, just like it erupted back in the 1800s in an event called the Carrington Event, which could wipe out many of our satellites, knock out power plants, cause short-circuiting of major centers on the planet Earth, knock out telecommunications, knock out computers and the internet and GPS. It could be a real mess. We physicists of the American Physical Society asked Congress to put up a few hundred million dollars to reinforce our power plants, build redundant systems, reinforce our satellites. However, we got nothing from the United States Congress. And so we're sitting ducks to a potential solar flare. However, I should point out that nobody, but nobody knows when we could have a monster solar storm once again like the Carrington event. And if you want to know more about gigantic solar flares, go to Google, type in Carrington event, and you can see what happened back then, a solar storm that could happen in the future. And our special guest is Professor Peter Ward, author of a book aptly entitled Flooded Earth. And he points a rather dismal picture of what happens in the future when the polar ice caps are completely melted. Already we've lost about 50% of the polar ice caps just within the last 50 years. And perhaps within the next 50 years, we may lose the polar ice caps entirely. And then what does that mean? What does that mean for a sea level rise? What does that mean for the weather? And of course, what does that mean for monster hurricanes? Now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. He's Professor Peter Ward. He's a professor of biology and earth and space science at the University of Washington in Seattle. The book is rather disturbing and is hitting the bookshelves this week. The book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. Now, on exploration, of course, we've had programs about global warming. We've talked about the effect on population and on agriculture and on tropical diseases. But here's a book that talks specifically about how our cities, some of our major cities, will go underwater or may have to be abandoned because of global warming. The book is controversial. However, it gives you a frame of reference as to what scientists are thinking if sea levels continue to rise, not 1 foot, 2 foot, but 5, 6, 7, 8 feet above normal. What happens to our great cities? What about warfare between nations when national borders begin to collapse because of mass migrations of hundreds of millions of people? Something to think about. Once again, the book is called The Flooded Earth.
Much more fun project. I've been in Rare Earth with Don Brownlee. I'd rather do astrobiology.
Oh, but well, I actually interviewed you, either you or Brownlee, I forgot.
Yeah, you did. And it just seems to be a happier topic to me to put my head in the sand, but unfortunately, I don't think we can do that much more.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Okay, well, the engineer gave us the go-ahead, so let's start with the first question. Oh, the first question that we always ask our guests is, how did you, as a youth now, get interested in science? So I'll lead off with that question. So, dig back to the cobwebs and think about what it was as a child that set you off in the direction of science. Okay, so the engineer said we're going to start in 10 seconds with that first question about you as a youth. Professor Ward, you're a professor of biology and earth and space science at the University of Washington in Seattle. However, as a youth, What steered you in the direction of science?
Well, thanks so much for having me. And I think scientists know from an early age that they're going to be scientists, so it was indeed youth. What got me going were dinosaurs. My mother and father were from New York. I grew up in Seattle. We didn't have a single dinosaur skeleton, and so I was given this guilt treatment that I had to be in Seattle, and it's my fault or something that there were no dinosaur skeletons, but that got me going.
Okay, and that set you off, and how did you get interested in astronomy and Earth and space science?
Well, I certainly started in paleontology, so I was looking at my feet all the time down at the ground, but it became evident, I think, in the first part of this century, or really the end of the 20th century, that there was a great deal to learn about life in space, and especially how other Earth could be constructed from what we knew in our own Earth history. And so deep Earth history can inform us about astrobiology, and in the book I've just done now, it is deep Earth history which can inform us about what climate change is capable of.
Okay, well, the book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. So let's start with the ice caps. The North Polar region, over the past 50 years, since submarines have visited the North Pole, seems to have decreased by 50% just in the last 50 years. So what is your projection of the North Pole and also Greenland going into the future?
Well, the great dream of the Europeans coming to North America was for the Northwest Passage. I mean, this was a driving impulse to try to find a quick trade route to China. We're going to have that. But what I really didn't understand thoroughly enough was the difference between an ice cap and an ice sheet. All of the North Polar ice cap can melt away, and it will have no effect, essentially, on sea level. It is the ice on land, the ice sheets, which are the biggest of which, of course, are Greenland and in Antarctica. Anything that melts on those goes directly into the ocean and raises the level of it. And the biggest, scariest scenario is equivalent to what we call an ice sheet collapse. So imagine you have a cup of really warm water and then dump in about 10 or 15 ice cubes, and up goes the level of that water really fast. Well, that is the scenario for an ice sheet collapse in Antarctica.
Okay, well, we've heard about what's happening in the North Polar region, but in the South Pole, we have huge chunks of ice breaking off, but what does that mean, given the fact that most of the South Pole seems stable, at least temporarily?
You know, I've come back from two separate trips to Antarctica over the last 2 years, and we're looking at deep-time events of the climate down there, but you can't help but notice what's going on all around you. It was melting like crazy. When you have both kinds of ice down there. You've got floating ice, which, again, if that melts, doesn't matter. But you've also got all this ice on land. When it melts, the water goes down to the ice rock contact, of course, and that acts as a lubricant. So when you have really anomalous warming, stuff that is on the edge of this can calve off into the ocean. That causes great global change in terms of sea level rise.
Okay, and talking about sea level rise, doesn't the heating of the Earth itself cause expansion of warm water, which causes the sea level to rise? Just the sheer fact that the Earth is warming up.
It sure does. And matter of fact, if we stopped all emissions right now, we just went completely emission neutral, the ocean is still going to rise in its level because of thermal expansion. There's been so much warming already that the ocean has a lag effect. But over the next 40, 50 years, we could expect nearly a 3-foot sea level rise if based on the temperatures that we have now and the continued warming, just from the thermal expansion, no ice at all.
Okay, 3-foot rise without any ice. And I guess for every 1-foot vertical that you lose, how much horizontal seacoast do you lose?
Well, the seacoast itself is affected more strongly by storm surge. And you can think of storm surge as equivalent to going off a diving board. You jump off a diving board at a given height, but if you bounce a couple of times, you go way higher. It's as if you have a launching platform as sea level rises. The storm surge, which are the nasty big waves that rise higher than normal sea level, can hit coasts. But the sideways movement of the ocean is far more serious in terms of what its salt does. Salt goes laterally quite easily, and depending on the type of soil, it is the salinization of the sea level crops that I think is the greatest single danger from sea level rise. It's stunning how much of the world's productivity, and especially the rice regions in Southeast Asia, are on deltas. A delta is built out from a river hitting a calm ocean. If you have a 3-foot sea level rise, every delta on this planet will disappear. We're talking about the Nile, the Brahmaputra, the Mekong, and these are all enormously productive areas. So this is the big blow that is coming. The equation is we're going to have a rise in sea level at the same time we have a rise in human population. As you know, we're at 6.6 billion now, but we're heading towards 9 billion. And this, too, is built into the system. It's kind of like the warmth of the ocean. We could do tremendous birth control efforts now, but we're probably still going to hit that 9 billion. So the intersection of 9 billion with reduced agricultural yields because of the sea level rise is the scariest aspect.
Okay, well, let's assume that we do nothing. That is, we simply treat everything as normal. We keep on spewing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Let's take the world 2050. In 2050, what will coastal cities like Boston, New York, Miami, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, what will they look like if we just keep spewing carbon dioxide in the air as if there was nothing wrong, and we project 50 years into the future?
Well, 2050 is still not going to be apparent that we're in a crisis. It's kind of like watching a speed car as it leaves the Indy 500. If you catch it in the first 10 feet or so, it's not going very fast. But acceleration is an interesting thing. It will be apparent to all city planners in 2050 that something new is going on, and they won't like it. Much of city infrastructure is now buried. People put down, obviously, all the sewage, but now so much of the electrical and advanced communication systems are underground. They were not engineered for salt water. They were engineered for fresh water. Bringing a lot of salt into city infrastructure is going to be a huge headache. It's also going to be a headache for trying to keep freshwater reservoirs going and freshwater aquifers. So 2050 is the time when the alarm bells are going to be ringing. The populace isn't going to see much. It might only be a foot rise by then, but certainly there will be urban red lights going off like crazy.
Well, that completes the first part of our interview with Professor Peter Ward, Professor of Biology at the University of Washington in Seattle. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. And once again, you may also want to pick up a copy of my latest book. It's called Physics of the Future, 5 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. In fact, it was among the top 10 books, the top 10 nonfiction books sold in the United States of America. And it was the number one science book in this country, Physics of the Future. Get a copy. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we brought on Dr. Peter Ward of the University of Washington at Seattle, author of an explosive new book hitting the stands right now, even as we speak. The book is called The Flooded Earth, our future in a world without ice caps. So what would it be like in a world where we lose Venice, we lose Miami, we lose Bangladesh, we lose the Mekong Delta? What happens when perhaps nuclear weapons are used to prevent mass migrations, which will inevitably happen as entire nations become flooded, and realize that 50% or so of the world's population lives next to the ocean, many of them in megacities? What happens when some of them go underwater? So once again, the book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. Think about it, and then ask yourself a question. How far are you from the ocean, and what is your height above sea level? Well, in New York City, a few years ago, we had a gigantic nor'easter which sent a surge of water into Manhattan, which flooded the subway system. And it was not even a very big storm that did that. And some people think that storm surges, even before sea level rise goes to catastrophic levels, storm surges could paralyze the electrical, the plumbing system, and the infrastructure of a city. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, storm surge is definitely the most dangerous short-term effect of this. Look, we saw what storm surge did to New Orleans. It wasn't so much the hurricane itself, Katrina, that battered New Orleans. It was the storm surge. And once again, your storm surge comes from a mean sea level. When you keep raising that mean sea level, storm surge goes up, way up, higher. The most endangered creatures are therefore freshwater plants. And what I really break in my heart is try to think what's going to happen to the Everglades. You've got this enormous freshwater biosystem, which will be so threatened by both storm surge and simply rise in sea level. You cannot live in salt water if you're a freshwater plant. And unfortunately, no saltwater plant, like a mangrove, makes food that humans can eat.
Something to think about. Now let's turn the wheels of time to 2100. What will the great cities of the world look like in 2100?
Well, 2100, there will be 3 feet, only 3 feet if we're lucky, and 5 to 6 feet if we're not lucky. And by lucky, I mean we turn off the lights right now. If it is business as usual, and I suspect it might be because of the increased population numbers, there will be that 3 to 5 foot. The most hard hit will be the wharves. Global transport by ship is still the main means of moving great amounts of food around. CNN projected when I was in Antarctica a few months ago that even a 1 foot rise in sea level will cause shipping terminals and ports and docks and dock heights to have to be modified. And their projection was $1 trillion or more by about 2040 just to spend on the docks. Now, San Francisco Airport, I've landed on that airport over and over and over. A 3 to 5 foot sea level rise in the Bay Area will remove that airport entirely. And so just from the economic points of view, that 3 to 5 foot sea level is going to cause such an enormous financial burden on coastal cities.
Okay, the big question, will cities have to be abandoned if sea levels continue to rise 3 to 5 feet, and which cities are we talking about?
Well, we've done a lot of projections on this, and I've been talking to some Dutch engineers. The consensus, and again, this is really just consensus of people looking forward, is that civilization and the cities now could probably absorb a 3 foot, 4 foot, even at the worst case scenario, a 5 foot sea level rise, and survive. But anything above 5 to 6 feet for a lot of cities is not survivable. New York has high ground. It can simply move back. But Miami cannot. Miami is, I think, the poster child of the type of city that will disappear, as Galveston, Texas will, much of the South Florida cities will, and the Netherlands, of course, is in huge trouble. They already have a significant, I think it's 30% of their land area is already under sea level. And they spend an appreciable amount of their GNP on dikes every year, dikes and the equivalent of dikes, sometimes big sandbars. When global economy gets hit hard, it affects everybody, and I think that's what's coming.
Well, what about Boston? Large parts of Boston were reclaimed since the Revolutionary War. If you look at old maps of Boston, large parts of Boston didn't exist until recently. So what's going to happen to Boston?
Yeah, all reclaimed parts of cities are going to go away. The same with my city of Seattle. Our entire bay, Elliott Bay it's called, there's an island. Our major shipping port is an island built up from reclaimed sediment, just as Boston is. And once again, the 3-foot sea level rise allows storm surge, the big storms, to come whipping in and remove a lot of that sediment. You're not going to be able to hold that together. So any city with reclaimed sediment construction, and lots of the airports in Asia, and especially in Japan, they've been building airports out on the water. China's just done it too. All those things will have to be rebuilt somewhere else.
And what about San Francisco, Los Angeles, and especially what's going to happen to New Orleans, where large parts of the city are actually under sea level?
I think New Orleans will have to be abandoned ultimately. It might be a century or two. San Francisco is very interesting. They're very progressive engineers down there. And believe it or not, they have a plan for building a dam right under the Golden Gate Bridge that would save every one of the Bay cities. You could hold off sea level rise by building this dam. Otherwise, it's going to be a whole series of smaller dikes and systems and try to save what you can and lose what otherwise. Los Angeles is in an interesting position, too, because the city itself has obviously a lot of high ground, but there are very low-lying areas in Los Angeles that, again, will be inundated to the point that some huge storm comes, salt water is pushed way inland through storm surge, killing off the plants that are there. And then what do you do when you're living in a house that is flooded out by not freshwater, salt water? A saltwater flooding event is way worse than a freshwater flooding event.
And what about London, where we have gigantic underwater devices to help control the water of the Thames River? Are we all going to be like that? Are we all going to be like the little Dutch boy putting our finger in gigantic dikes that we're going to build around our cities? What are we going to do about this?
Well, the British have thought a lot about sea level rise, too, and they are planning on contingencies for up to 5 feet. And you just really hit it. They're thinking about what sort of engineering do we have to do to save our cities? Historic cities such as London and any of the cities in the Mediterranean will do everything and anything to try to keep their shorelines as they are now. But it really all depends on where we can stop this. Look, if we melt every single glacier on the planet, we have a sea level rise of over 200 feet. That was the case less than 17,000 years ago. We know from the deep past that when carbon dioxide has been 1,000 parts per million, there is no ice sheet. And we're at 380, 390 and climbing. It's just that to me is the spookiest aspect of it all.
Okay, and what's going to happen to growing areas of the world? Like California has the San Joaquin Valley. Other places have gigantic growing areas. What happens when salt water begins to intrude upon these growing areas?
Agriculture becomes very dicey. Obviously, the San Joaquin Valley is enormously threatened. 20 years ago, it was already recognized that there's salt creeping in. Once again, if sea level goes up a little, salt goes sideways a whole lot. And if any sort of salt within your soil reduces productivity and ends to the point that you can no longer grow crop plants. So this San Joaquin Valley itself is endangered. The northern Sacramento Valley is in trouble. And as I mentioned earlier, every delta on the planet and all that rice from Southeast Asia, those are the targeted places that we should worry about most agriculturally.
Okay, and well, let's be very specific. I live in Manhattan. Manhattan is a little bit above sea level. The place where I am is about, I don't know, 15, 20 feet above sea level. However, certain parts of Manhattan are very close to sea level. Wall Street, for example. So what is Manhattan going to look like, and are we going to have to use a system of dikes to prevent the flooding of Manhattan?
Yeah, there will have to be some sort of mitigation going on in Manhattan, if not for the sea level rise itself, certainly for the storm surge. Again, a small level storm surge is the takeoff point for, or I'm sorry, a small level sea level rise is the takeoff point for storm surge. And in my book, I actually did some elevation counts for various areas and various streets in New York, and not off the top of my head, I actually projected winners and losers in mm-hmm. New York City and its boroughs.
Okay, and let's talk about Venice. Engineers have seriously looked at the problem of Venice. San Marco Plaza, the famous plaza, is actually underwater for parts of the year. So what have we learned by trying to do these gigantic engineering projects like for Venice?
Well, Venice is really interesting because they're putting out into the bay that Venice faces what is sort of a non-traditional dike in a way. It's not like a single wall that the little Dutch boy can put his finger in. But what is interesting and sort of alarming for Venice is also in Holland, it's not just the sea level rise, but it's the fact that the rivers behind yourself, these big cities were often built upon rivers. And because we've got global warming, it's not snowing in many of the mountains, in the Alps and in the Sierra, for instance, snow level is higher. And so instead of snowing in the winter, it rains. And these rivers rise at times they never used to rise before. So Venice is fighting a two-front war, as is many of the Dutch cities. You have to worry about the river that runs through you as much as the sea coming at you. And as any of the military geniuses said, two-front wars are often hard to win.
So Venice may have to be abandoned at some point, you figure?
I would suspect, yes.
Okay, and your book goes beyond 2100, goes to 2300 and beyond. So what is the coastline of the world going to look like now beyond 2100? If I have a map of the world, what will school children see? The North Pole gone? The coastline changing? What will the Earth look like beyond 2100?
Well, it really boils down to some simple geology. Continents, as we know, move around. In the direction that they move, like North America's west coast, there are high mountains generally. But trailing edges, we call them passive edges, don't have mountains, or they have mountains that eroded away, as our east coast does. So you've got the enormous Gulf Plain, you've got the enormous east coast plain in front of the Appalachians. There will be inroads all through that. The problem that we see is that most estimates and models think up to 2100 and stop. But at 2100, if it's business as usual, say we kept it at 3 feet, it doesn't stop there. It keeps going in accelerated fashion. So if you have 3 to 5 feet by 2100, it's not going to mean that you would have twice that by 2200. You could have three times that high. The acceleration is the most ominous aspect of this business.
So let's just do a computer program. Assume that at some point we stop greenhouse gases into the future, but we just let the computer program run. What will the world look like? Will all the great cities be underwater by then, by 2200, 2300?
No, ice sheets in Antarctica, they are thinning, and they're thinning in both Greenland and Antarctica. A great deal of that water is going in, but the ice sheets are enormously thick in both places. Greenland is far more endangered than Antarctica is. You're not going to see a wholesale flooding of the cities by 2200 or even 2300, which possibly gives us time, but you're certainly going to see effects where the cities that will have to be abandoned, I think that will already be taking place. We just have to maintain these ice sheets with as much integrity as we can, and that means slowing the global warming temperatures, which seem to be inexorable. Look, we just went through this huge recession. We should have had 2 or 3 years because of the economic downturn, when emissions could have been or should have been reduced. They weren't. I mean, they're right up at the IPCC's maximum emission prediction. We're not lowering emissions. We're increasing emissions.
Okay. Now, let's go into the past. You can do that because we can drill into the ice cap and get ice cores from thousands of years ago. 10,000 years ago, we had the Ice Age. It was very cold, 10,000 years and beyond that. So how far back in time do you have to go to find a time similar to what we're going to be experiencing in the future? And what did the world look like at that time?
Well, the conventional answer is that if we get up to 1,000 parts per million, which would happen in 2 centuries from now, if we have some sort of control on emissions, a lot of us think that 1,000 parts per million would be a lot sooner than that. But you are going all the way back to a time called the Eocene. And the Eocene time when we had crocodiles up on the North Pole. We had palm trees in Seattle. We just had this wonderfully tropical climate. The bad news is that sea level was 240 feet higher than it is now because there was no ice. There were no ice sheets at all on the planet.
And when was that?
This was about 50 million years ago, mm-hmm. but we only have to go back 110,000 years ago to see a world where sea level was at least 10 feet higher than now. Mm-hmm. And there's great evidence of this in Florida. In the Florida Keys, there's a beautiful quarry in Windley Key. It's a national park. And you can see big coral heads sitting 4 or 5 feet above sea level. Now, if you go offshore with your mask and flippers, you find the same corals, big Montastria they're called, living down about 10 feet deep. That's the shallowest they can live. So here is evidence, and we can date these with radiometric dating, that 105, 110,000 years ago, sea level was 10 feet higher than it is now, and the entire geography of that place was different. What caused that short-term rise, and this was a blip in the Ice Age, was orbital changes, but at the same time, we had a slight increase in carbon dioxide, and these two conspired to cause a great melt enough to produce a 10-foot rise in sea level.
Uh-huh, 10-foot rise in sea level. So the ice caps, they disappeared 150,000 years ago?
Well, we have very little fossil record of what an ice cap shape looked like because mm-hmm. it's floating ice. It doesn't leave any record of itself in sedimentary rock. But we have pretty good evidence on if there's an ice sheet because of the scratches and striations that moving ice produces. You can date some of these surfaces and get an idea about the direction of the ice and even in many cases the thickness of the ice depending on how deep the grooves were.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a pretty good sense of when there was ice and when there wasn't.
Okay. Well, now let's talk about mass migrations and how that could affect world politics. We've had Peter Schwartz of the Global Business Network on our show, and Peter Schwartz is a consultant for the United States Pentagon. And the Pentagon asked the Global Business Network a very simple question. What does global warming mean for the military? What kinds of military conflicts could arise because of global warming? And they looked at the maximum case, and the maximum case shows that you could have mass migrations of not just a million, but tens of millions, maybe even hundreds of millions of people. Look at the situation in Bangladesh, for example. And at that point, national borders could begin to crumble. How do you stop 10 million people from crawling all over your national borders? And what will nations do at that point? At that point, according to the Global Business Network, nations may reach for nuclear weapons to preserve the integrity of their national borders. And they specifically looked at certain hotspots where we have two opposing nuclear powers, and then the question of what happens when borders disintegrate. So what do you think?
Well, the unfortunate thing, I never knew about the Peter Schwartz report, but 2 years ago when I started writing this book, I actually put a 5-page scenario of exactly that, of Bangladesh really collapsing under not just the fact that much of it was being inundated by salt water, but once again, it's that pesky lateral movement. It's not just that they won't have a place to live, it's that the crops fail. I mean, Bangladesh feeds itself now, but barely. But they're projected to have a gigantic population rise. At the same time, they're going to lose this 3-crop rotation per year. And so my scenario certainly sees Bangladeshis pushing into India and India pushing back militarily. Actually, I got this scenario not from the Pentagon, but the CIA several years ago did the very similar sort of assessment. And they, I think, quite presciently said, yes, sea level rise is going to cause migration of borders. One aspect of it that you may not think about right off the bat is sea level rise is going to affect not only coastal cities and coastal agriculture, but much of the transportation corridors on land occur right near or at sea level. Transportation lines, major highways, lots and lots of rail lines, these things will go out very quickly because of storm surge. So when you're talking about mass migration now, if we're the case where sea level is producing mass migration, we're probably in a world where the normal transportation infrastructure has been highly degraded, let's put it that way.
And what about megacities? If you take a look at population rise, it's not uniform across the world. More and more peasants are leaving the farms, going into these gigantic megacities, creating gigantic mega slums. And of course, they're next to the water. So what happens when they get flooded? Where are they going to go? We're talking about hundreds of millions of people potentially being pushed out of their new home. What's going to happen then?
Well, because most megacities are surrounded in one case or another by at least small to large farmlands. I mean, it's traditionally it was the case where you had the city, you had the farms surrounding it. Agricultural land will be inundated with humans, and this just exacerbates the problem of feeding ourselves. We're really looking at a case where, look, the elephant in the room is just too many people on this planet. It's just at this stage, we have to deal with the idea that the human population can continue to do as it's doing unimpeded. Whatever happened to zero population growth, that movement in the 70s that said slow down, that has disappeared entirely, and that is the single most important part of the equation.
Okay, now that we've painted a picture of what our children, our grandkids, and our great-great-grandkids may face, then the question is, well, what are they going to say when they look back at us? What did we do to prevent this disaster from happening? So do you have any positive thoughts about what could be done, or is it inevitable?
No, actually, there's quite a bit of hope. Look, let's go back 5 years. Global warming was certainly a topic, but I would bet that you would have a hard time finding a single person on the planet now who hasn't heard in one language or another those two words strung together and have a sense of the implications. There has been an enormous amount of work to get the information out. I have to take a shot at journalists because journalism now is really based on this idea that you have a pro and a con, that every story has to have the negative side. And what makes me laugh is I can imagine somebody now doing an interview about gravity, and here's Isaac Newton, and the anti-gravity side says this. We really have to continue the sense that the word has to get out. And what I find most hopeful is I teach college kids, their generation gets it, their generation is worried, and their generation is doing things about it. And that's my sense of it, that we are going to get a hold of this thing, that we're going to find better and more alternative energy sources. We have to get off the coal habit. They keep saying we're addicted to oil, but the addiction to coal is way worse, way, way worse. And that coal is the cheapest form of energy on our planet, and it is, in a sense, centuries' worth is there. It's not like peak oil. Peak coal is centuries away.
Now, the Chinese are building one coal plant per week. Every week, a new coal plant is created in China. And to be fair, they're also creating solar panels as well. But what's going to replace coal? Even if we reduce our dependency on oil, even though we go electric cars get their electricity from coal. So electric cars, in some sense, make it worse because they get their energy from coal. So what's going to replace coal?
Well, hopefully we have many things. There's not going to be any one single thing. And we're going to have to, again, I hold my nose, embrace nuclear. We're going to have to hope and pray that the experiments taking place in Berkeley in the labs there for fusion reactors work. I mean, if we can harness fusion power, boy, we're in great shape. But I think what we're going to have to find are enormous changes in lifestyle. Let's take one. We really need to erase airplane travel the way it is now. Airplanes are horrible polluters. You know, what's wrong with airships, lighter-than-air airships? What's wrong with staying home for vacation? And we scientists, we're among the worst. You know, we flip from place to place, from conference to conference. What about nice old sailing ships? You know, I bring up these ideas, and people laugh at me, but can you imagine a beautiful stateroom? You've got your Wi-Fi, and you've got your computer, and you take 5 days to get to your conference. Things have to slow down. Things have to centralize. We need to have old-fashioned medieval cities, centralized, compressed living, circled by farms. The food you produce around you is the food you eat. That is the model for how to survive. What is the next? The big danger is the next 2 centuries. The big danger is the next century, really, with this pulse in human population.
And what reaction have you gotten? A lot of snickers and a lot of eyes roll to the ceilings when you talk about a lifestyle of the Middle Ages?
Well, they call me Cassandra, and I get this Chicken Little over and over and over. I tried to do an op-ed piece for the New York Times, and they wrote back saying, well, we're not going to print this. And I said, why not? Said, well, it's not that we don't believe you. It's just that it's such a horrible fate that it's just not going to happen. Okay, why not? Well, it's just it can't because it's too terrible. So why scare people? Even if it's going to happen, it's too terrible, so it won't happen.
They actually said that to you?
Yeah, written. I mean, just said, nope, can't do this.
So if it's too terrible,
it makes me laugh.
If it's too terrible, it's not going to happen because it's too terrible.
Exactly. And that's pretty much what I get from most of this conversation.
And last question. If you were to estimate or take a guess as to the most likely scenario, we painted, of course, a worst-case scenario and temperatures keep on rising and so on and so forth. But if you were to then say what is the most likely scenario, what would you say?
I say the population peaks at 9 billion, goes back down to 7 and 6. I say that emissions go up to about 600, and then we bring it back down to the mid-400s.
And why do they go down again? Things don't go down for nothing.
Well, they go down because if we can reduce population, they certainly will go down. And if we can increase the efficiency of power plants, if we can bring in the solar, bring in all these possibilities, yes, they will go down. But I do think we're going to have a case where sea level, in my own estimation, sea level will certainly hit 5 or 6 feet above what it is now, and hopefully doesn't go any higher than that.
Okay, and maybe our properties will be underwater by then.
Well, if you have a view property now, it'll be a waterfront property. And if you have a waterfront property now, you could make it an underwater park.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, you've been listening to our special guest, Professor Peter Ward, Professor of Biology and Earth and Planetary Science at the University of Washington in Seattle. The book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.